Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, January the 16th, 2025. This is episode 3611 of the Survival Podcast. And today we are going to talk about, well, a whole bunch of things because it is Thursday. That means it's time for the Expert Council Q&A show for the week. I got a bunch of stuff for you today. I'm going to lead off today. I usually do anchor, and I'm going to do that too. I got a really short lead today. I'm going to tell you why, if you use Brink Security, you should get rid of them. If you know somebody who uses Brink Security, you should tell them to get rid of them. And if you know somebody who might ever buy a security system, you should tell them not to do business with Brinks. And it has nothing to do with the quality of service, though that probably sucks too. Just, I think a company that kicks a person in the nuts when they're in the middle of the worst moment of their life is scum. And when a company ends up turning out to be woke as fuck too, they really need to go. You'll hear all about it. It'll take about as long as it did for me to lay that out for you, for me to tell you what they did and more that I've learned about them. Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams will talk about Marco Rubio. He's going to be the Secretary of State. But is a globalist like Rubio going to last long in an organization that's at least talking the way Trump's is? I don't know. But I'll tell you something I know about Marco from somebody that knew him really, really well at one time. And somebody I thought was actually going to say, no, you're not being fair to him. He said, you're not being hard enough on this piece of crap. So I'll tell you about that. Andy McCann will talk about timing your meals or fast, either or, when it comes to working out. Ryan Steva will talk about protecting your biggest liability. Now, your accountant calls it your biggest asset. That is your house. Now, in spite of what Ryan says in this, and he's right, I have said this many times, and I did pick this up from Robert Kiyosaki, not my favorite source of all things, but he gets some things really right. Your home generally is your biggest liability. I try to talk about ways to change that, but it is your biggest liability, especially when you owe way more money you could ever come up with at one time on it. John Pugliano will talk about choosing an investment advisor or investment manager. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about the debate among chicken wing eaters. Blue cheese or ranch? I say F some ranch. It's disgusting. It doesn't belong on chicken at all. But he actually has a third one in there. Sour cream. No. But we'll see what Ken has to say. Now, sour cream I have used for. But sour cream does not go on a chicken wing. Not in my opinion. Michael Melito will talk about the skinny on cool crossover carbines. And I will have some thoughts on that because I like carbines. And notice I said crossover, not pistol caliber. There's a lot in this one. And there's one of these guns that he mentions I really, really, really have an affection for. And then, how do you price your meat and egg products based on your market is what I'm calling my segment. But I don't have a great answer for this person, but I think it's a really important follow-up question to my show from Tuesday on the emerging or growing underground meat industry. And, of course, when we did that show, I talked about how it wasn't just really meat. It's just animal products, milk, eggs, and actual meat. I'm going to try to approach this one. You know, the guy's in Canada, so I don't know the law there, but I'm going to try to make sure that people aren't misunderstanding what I'm saying to do a lot of the time. Like, you don't do something just to do it. You do something because it makes sense for you economically and logistically. All right? So we're going to be talking about all of that. Before we do, let me remind you, you can help support this show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I'll throw that at the beginning today instead of the end. I've got a few products that I brought out this week and one other one that I want to mention. One, the one I brought out for you guys yesterday, I brought it around before, the 2-inch nursery pots. These are fantastic, and they are made by a company called Hydroponic City. And they're fine for hydro systems, but I use them just for regular seed starting. They have a real advantage based on their space. And since they're designed for hydro, the drainage holes on them are fantastic. The bottom is designed fantastically. Mine are going into their second season. I did two runs of starts last year, so it's the third use, and they're still fine. And they cost about 20 cents a piece. The other one I brought you this week are the Stabilizer slip-on ice cleats. And as I've been saying about these, this is a prepper thing that you should have. If you live where ice happens, you need either these or something like them. The severity of injury that comes every year to thousands of people who slip on ice is really, you wonder why more people don't do it. And the older you get, the more serious those injuries are. You know, the old pediatrician's joke with kids with broken bones, if you get the two bones in the same room together, they'll heal. As we age, that shit changes. And as we start crossing, you know, kind of monument birthdays like 50, for men it's 40, okay? It's 50, 65, 70, and then pretty much every year after that, there's some level of decline no matter how well you take care of yourself. And I think Andy McCann said something like, it's like you are 65 or 70% more likely to die in any year that you fall after your 67th birthday. It was something enough to get my attention. And I have had, it wasn't even a serious injury, but it was painful. And it could have been way worse. It's in the write-up. And as I said yesterday, like, you know, you have primary areas that you're going to hurt yourself with a fall like this. Your ankle and knees, you know, your back, your arms, and your frickin' head. And if you're a dude and you're like, I don't mean it. Okay, your whole family has to deal with your shit while you're laid up, or maybe feed you through a straw for the rest of your life if you have a bad enough head injury. And I had a wake-up call with that. You can read about it. But I wouldn't be telling you all this and going on and on about this if I didn't really believe it was important. And because I don't give a crap what product you buy. If you want to use T-Spaz and you want to buy the ones I recommend, that's great. If you want to buy something made by the same company where you know you're going to use them more and you want to go a little higher end, that's fine. If you want to buy it from somebody else, as long as it's quality and it works. Because nobody is immune to freaking gravity, okay? Just bluntly. And it's something we need to take seriously. And it ain't the ice you know about that's the most dangerous. It's the ice you don't see. It's that little bit of thin ice at the edge of the patio where the water came off the roof and you didn't know it and it got there and it looks clean and it looks safe. It's the ice that formed under the snow in the depression that you're just walking through the snow all happy, and that's what happened to me. So please take that seriously. With that, let's go ahead and drop into our first segment, which is the flow's messed up, right? It's going to be me. It's never me that's first. I got to tell you this shit that I just learned about Brinks, and I have confirmed that they're doing it, and it is standard practice. There's a guy I follow on Twitter, X. I keep calling it Twitter. It's X. We need to stop calling it Twitter X or X Twitter or X formerly Twitter, and just it is X. So there's a guy I follow on X, and his father, they lost their house in the California fires that we talked about yesterday. It's gone. There is no house. They had a Brinks security system, and, you know, it's a monthly expense at a time when you've lost everything you own. So they call Brinks and, like, we're not going to be needing this security system anymore. Why? Because there is no more house. Oh, okay, no problem. I'd be happy to take that for you. Breaking your contract will cost you $4,000. You understand there's no house? Yes, sir, I understand that. I'm not going to do it. It's $4,000. You got to be kidding me. Well, it's in the contract, Jack. You're supposed to believe in contracts as a good libertarian and anarchist without the state even, like a contract is a contract. Oh, well, let me tell you about their contract. So another gentleman chimes in when I shared this and said, yeah, it was either him or his dad or somebody wanted to get a security system. I think he directly did. Yeah, it was him. He said he shopped around, said their price and service seemed good. So they send over an e-document where you e-sign it, and it said, just sign this and we'll get you installed. Well, it's one page, and it doesn't say anything about what the contract actually has in it. It's like a bill on the floor of the house. You got to pass it to find out what's in it. I'm not fucking kidding. So he says, no way. Calls the CSR back and says, hey, I want to see the whole contract before I sign this. And they said, well, you can't see the whole contract till after it's installed. He says, well, bullshit, get me a supervisor. He doesn't get to talk to a supervisor until the next day. That should be a red flag. The supervisor confirms, it is our policy that we do not hand out these contracts to people engaging in business with us until after they actually sign the contract. So I got two things to say here. One, Brinks needs to experience massive pain for this. My personal goal right now is to tell enough people that tell enough people that tell enough people that they tried to fuck this man out of $4,000. I want them fucked out of $4 million. Okay? And I think we can make that happen. I think you and I together, dear listener, we have the horsepower to make that happen, and these scumbags deserve it. But I am not done yet. Oh, no, 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 no. This shit about the contract? Okay. There are ambulance-chasing, blood-sucking, parasitic lawyers in this world. But every form, we learn this in permaculture, right? Every form of life has a purpose. I have never heard of a purpose more suited to a blood-sucking attorney than this. A blood-sucking attorney who specializes in class action lawsuits. Now, I realize the average person with the Brinks security system, it will probably get a check for about $5 if they sign off on the class action suit. I don't care. I want maximum pain. I see this as being like, this could be a $100 million lawsuit. You imagine that? So every single customer with a Brinks security system probably had the same thing happen. They were asked to sign a contract that they didn't get to read. And you could say, oh, well, but they didn't ask to read it. No, wait a minute. What we've now established is Brinks has a policy that they won't show you the contract that you signed, which means none of these people ever had the opportunity to review the contract they agreed to. We need an army of freaking leech-level contract, class action lawyers to look at this. So if you know somebody that's in that line of work, or you know somebody that knows, you need to tip them off to this. But please do me a favor. You guys, I know there's going to be people on any given episode like, man, I'm not really in for this. Like, who is this guy asking me to do? I don't do this. This is something that will pop up on my show about once every 4 or 5 years. Somebody will do something this grievous, and I'll say we should do something about it. I'm asking you as a favor. I'm asking you to tell every single person you know about this. I'm asking you, I'll put a link in the show notes today that goes to the X Post, so you can use that. I don't care how you do it. I just want you to let every human that will listen to you know you shouldn't do business with Brinks because this is what they're doing. They're charging people $4,000 to get out of a contract when they don't have a house anymore in the middle of the California wildfires. And I want you to tell them that the contract that the person agreed to, they were never permitted to read. And I'll put a link to where you can find that as well. All right? Now, let's hear about Marco Rubio from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams.
Right now, as we speak, it may be over by now. They'd be probably questioning Marco Rubio. Yeah. I think he wants to be the Secretary of State. Yeah. That's a pretty good job, isn't it? I mean, a lot of responsibility, things like that. So, but there's argument. They sometimes they talk about is he going to be appointed or not? But most people think he'll be appointed. But the big betting is going on now. How long is he going to last? He's going to be 1 year or 2 years, or is he going to be there the whole time of Trump's administration, the next 4 years?
Well, the hearings are going on today. Now, on the one hand, he's a shoo-in. He's one of them. We talked about it before the show. Plenty of Democrat senators like him for a number of reasons. There are a lot of hawks on the D side as well, and they like the fact that Marco Rubio really is a dyed-in-the-wool neocon. He's an old-school neocon. That's what he's all about. He's always been about that. He basically is a John Bolton type of character. He's never seen a potential war that he did not want to turn into an actual war. But, you know, we noticed this morning an article in Politico, which is quite interesting for a number of reasons. And I put that first clip on, which is that he may not last very long in the job. And that's the title of it. Marco Rubio isn't likely to last long as Secretary of State. And there's a number of reasons. If you go to the next clip, unlike many of President-elect Donald Trump's nominees, Rubio is a shoo-in for Senate confirmation. Exactly. Having nabbed Democrat support, U.S. diplomats and foreign officials too view the GOP senator from Florida as a knowledgeable, not insane, now that's questionable, not insane, well-behaved person with whom they can engage. But the thing that's interesting about this article for me, Dr. Paul, is that, you know, every administration puts its own mark on how D.C. does business. And I think what we're starting to see here now is that the Trump 2.0 is going to be a different kind of administration than Trump 1.0. And I think that's what we're seeing. And that's what this article does a pretty good job of fleshing out, which is that what Trump is doing is bringing in someone to the State Department who will not be a strong Secretary of State. He's degrading the position of Secretary of State. Now, that's my opinion, and I think I can back it up fairly well. So Trump was definitely elected on a new kind of foreign policy. People were sick of Biden's wars. He said, I'm going to be a peace candidate. I'm going to end the wars. Now, a lot of people understand that a lot of that is just campaign rhetoric. However, that was appealing to people. So when you do that, but you appoint as your top diplomat someone who loves wars and thinks we need more of them, a lot of the MAGA base, remember how upset people, you and I couldn't believe it, Rubio of all people, you know, really? I finally understood why Trump picked Rubio. At the time, we were all depressed. We thought we were going to get a better group of people, a group of leaders. I think I finally understand what it is. He's picking Marco Rubio to be the lightning rod at state for all of the things that he's taking outside of state's purview. And the writer of this article, I like it because it agrees with me. Go to this next clip, because I think this is where you start sort of sussing out what's happening. He says, but Rubio will be lucky to last a year at Foggy Bottom. Rubio is already being undermined through pushback from Trump's MAGA base. We talked about that. The naming of other Trump appointees with overlapping portfolios, as well as the essentially weak nature of the position he's inheriting. So he's being undermined because the position of Secretary of State is to be downgraded in favor of people that are closer to Trump, his envoys, his national security advisor, and others. Now, this is where Politico goes Politico, because they're nervous about this. Go to the next one. A Rubio departure could mean fewer restraints on Trump's already unorthodox foreign policy, further rattling America's global allies. Now, again, this is Politico being Politico because they're nervous that Trump might actually pursue a different kind of foreign policy. Some of it may sound bizarre, and certainly to the establishment like Politico, it will.
In many ways, Trump is in a position where he's going to have a difficulty pleasing both sides of that.
Yeah.
So some of you that come to a lot of workshops will be able to figure out who I'm talking about, but I'm not going to put his name on the air because he may not want that. There is a person that's been a very long-time member of this community. He's also a person that worked really hard and did really well for himself and retired fairly young as a multimillionaire, and he continues to give back to his community. This is a solid, solid man. Well, he also was an affluent member in South Florida where Marco Rubio came up, and when Marco decided to go beyond local politics and run for the House of Representatives, I believe was the first thing or the Senate, whatever he did first when he went federal, this gentleman met with him, made major contributions to his campaign, and said, when you get there, don't forget where you came from. And then he won that election, and he would meet with this gentleman about once a year. Well, the first 2 years after he got elected, he said that he always met with him, was very cordial, treated him like the friend that he was. And, you know, after he got reelected the second time, when he went to talk to him, he wouldn't even talk to him. He sent him a staffer. And the staffer was 100% just bullshit, yes, man. And he cannot even speak to this man now whose career he helped launch. I'm not going to say that really speaks to the character of Marco Rubio. I know you would expect that I would. No. I'm going to say that speaks to what politics in D.C. is. What becoming a representative does, unless you have a freaking, like, iron spine, you know, screw that, like a titanium spine, like Thomas Massie. Unless you're that person, because you don't even give a shit if you get reelected. You're there to do a thing, and if you can't do that thing, what's the point of being there? Unless you're that guy, it is like making a slow deal with the devil. In, you know, movies and pop culture and all, always the devil shows up, some nicely dressed guy, looks like a British celebrity or a really cool dude in a zoot suit or something, and says, let me make you a deal, man. I'll do all this for you, and you just sign over your soul to me. But the real Satan, which government is, takes your soul an ounce at a time over time, and we wake up one day, and it's gone. That's what happened to Marco Rubio. That's what happened to so many people. Because as easy it is just to demonize all these people, almost every one of them that I've been able to track down that knew some, that knew, somebody that knew them closely in the before, has a similar story. Yeah, and you want to know why I don't participate in politics. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Andy McCann on timing your workouts with your meals, or the impact of doing something like intermittent fasting on your workout and how those all fold in and work together.
Hey there, everyone. We've got an awesome question from Jacques, who's clearly crushing it out there. Jacques, you're 51, running 4 miles a day for 5 years, and now you're mixing in strength training? That's incredible. You're already ahead of the game, so let's make sure we keep you moving in the right direction. Jacques asks about the relationship between intermittent fasting and workout timing. He's on a noon to 8 p.m. eating window and trains from 6:30 to 8 a.m. running and lifting weights. The big concern, missing post-workout protein due to fasting and whether breaking the fast would help with muscle recovery and growth. First, let's give Jacques some props. Jacques, what you're doing is no small feat. Consistency, endurance, and now strength training. You're on a roll. Seriously, give yourself a high five for being so proactive with your fitness. Post-workout protein, the basics. When you work out, especially with weights, you're breaking down muscle fibers. To rebuild those fibers and grow stronger, your body needs protein. Ideally, you'd consume protein within 30 minutes to 2 hours post-workout. Skipping it doesn't mean all is lost, but eating sooner gives you a clear edge. Intermittent fasting, the trade-off. Fasting has amazing benefits, better insulin sensitivity, potential fat loss, and even cellular cleanup, autophagy. But fasting and muscle building don't always play perfectly together. Your muscles don't know you're fasting, they just know they're hungry for protein. Solve one problem at a time. Here's the key, prioritize. Solve one problem first, then layer in the rest. Since you've just added strength training, muscle recovery should take the front seat. Building strength now will pay huge dividends for your health and longevity. Suggestions for Jacques. Shift your eating window. Move it earlier, like 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., so you can eat post-workout and still fast. Add a small protein shake. Some believe a little post-workout protein won't disrupt fasting benefits much. Try 10 to 20 grams of whey or BCAAs. Stay the course. If fasting benefits are top priority, let your body adapt. Recovery will still happen when you eat later, just less optimized. What's most important? Right now, prioritize muscle recovery. Strength training isn't just about building muscle, it's about long-term health. Once you've got that routine locked in, tweak your fasting protocol as needed. Final thoughts. Jacques, you're doing fantastic. Focus on one thing at a time. Nail your recovery now, and you'll keep improving. For everyone else out there, keep sending in your questions. I'm here to help. You can find me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42 and my podcast, Fitness, Food, Finances. Let's keep moving forward together.
All right, now let's hear from Nick Ferguson on rooting elderberries.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with an expert counsel answer for Tom and PJ on rooting mulberry cuttings. Tom says, for Nick Ferguson, Nick, what advice can you give me for the best way to root mulberry cuttings? Details. I'm in zone 5A and have been having variable success and speed. with rooting red mulberry cuttings from wild volunteer trees. Is commercial rooting hormone really needed? Probably. I've stuck pencil thick or greater hardwood cuttings either in early or late winter, either in pots or in the garden soil directly. Sometimes I get it right and get more than 10% to root, but sometimes I get almost nothing. Thank you, Tom from Wisconsin. And PJ, a prior client of mine in Central Texas, has emailed me with a similar question, so I'm going to kind of answer both of them at the same time. You can certainly try winter hardwood cuttings, but all the literature I can find actually suggests summer softwood or hardwood cuttings. So I'm going to give you like three different protocols because I've found three different ones, and they vary wildly, actually. So in my book, let me look. In the reference manual of Woody Plant Propagation, second edition, the gist of what they suggest is 8,000 ppm IBA talc midsummer cuttings, and they report 100% rooting success in sand. No notes on intermittent mist, which kind of surprises me. I would assume that would be under intermittent mist. And the references... And there are references suggesting that this protocol also works on hardwoods. And they also say root cuttings in early winter also work. Another protocol suggests summer hardwood cuttings with 2,000 ppm IBA, and that works great under mist. No real data on the percentage of take, but it seemed to be very successful like that. And those were summer hardwood cuttings. And then another resource by the University of Florida suggests summer hardwood cuttings in an IBA quick dip of 12,000 ppm under intermittent mist worked. That's basically a bit stronger than straight dip and grow at 10,000 ppm. So that's kind of crazy. That makes me think that there's, like, 12,000 is a freaking lot. So I'm wondering if that's a typo, because dadgum, wow. I would have thought closer to 2,000 for summer cuttings, but I don't know. Depending on the cultivar, those protocols might not work for you. There's not a whole lot out there from scholarly sources, and I've just not been able to find that many. So I'd say if you have the materials this winter, try hardwood cuttings. They might take, they might not. If they don't, no big deal. Simply wait till this summer and try each of those protocols and see which one works for your tree. Because always remember, these protocols are kind of a jumping off point because your mileage is going to vary. Sometimes you're going to have to tweak things one way or another because even within the same species, different cultivars have slightly different genetics, and what works for one might not work for another. And then PJ asked if he should prune these trees that he wants to train into more of a bush form, if he should do that now or closer to spring. And for you, man, I'd suggest pruning as soon as possible while they're still dormant because, you know, the kind of climatological band that you and I are in, most likely we're not going to have too many more cold weeks, and you really don't want sap running when you prune mulberries because they will bleed to death. Ask me how I know. Thanks for the great questions, guys. Keep them coming. I'm going to be headed to Fort Smith, Arkansas to speak at a fundraiser for Caleb House, and it's a ministry that's a residential recovery program providing a safe home-like environment for families and child survivors of sex trafficking. Really fantastic ministry. I'm going to be up there the weekend of March the 7th through 9th. So if you're in the region, or like the Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri kind of region, and you want to book a consult, let me know via email with consulting in the subject line, and check out the plant packs that are flying off the shelf over at rareplantstore.com. Do good things.
I'll just say my experience with them has been that if you take a good softwood cutting in, you know, late spring, put it in moist soil, keep it in the shade, it's almost 100% doing nothing else. Now, that's maybe my specific cultivar. I don't know, but that's been my experience. It's really that easy. And there are certainly plants that have certain times that cuttings are just stupid easy and some that aren't. One that that makes me think of is goji berry. I mean, you take goji berry in the spring and you take a softwood cutting that is at that point where you can bend it and it kind of snaps, but it doesn't break, but it doesn't just fold over. You almost can't keep it from rooting. If it touches dirt, it's going to throw a root out. The rest of the year, you got to use other effective measures to get it to root. So do that with as you will. Next up, let's hear about protecting your home. There's a lot of reasons to be thinking about that right now.
Hey, Jack and the TSP community. This is Ryan Steva. I am a licensed home inspector in the state of Tennessee. And today I want to talk a bit about protecting your greatest liability. If you've listened to Jack's show for any period of time, you're probably aware that he oftentimes calls your home a liability, whereas most financial planners, advisors will consider your home on the asset side of the liability sheet. So I'm calling this protecting your greatest liability to play on that. One of the things that I see as being the biggest detriment or problem or point of damage for homes in pretty much all places and all states and in all circumstances is water intrusion. And one of the biggest ways that you end up getting water intrusion is from something called negative grade. Now, negative grade is where the grading or the yard around the home slopes toward the home, allowing water to run up against and potentially into the home. There's multiple negative consequences of this, and I want to talk about both what the negative consequences are, how to spot it, and how to address it. So let's dive in right there. What are some of the potential negative side effects or issues caused by a negative grade? Well, a big one is something called wood-destroying organisms. So in traditional building, you are going to have a lot of wood as the structural portion of the home just above the foundation. And you can have things like termites or fungus that can actually get into the wood and do damage. And the damage that is done is oftentimes invisible until it becomes structurally significant. So both of those things are highly encouraged by moisture in the soil in and around the home. So removing moisture will make a significant difference in the potential for having termite issues or having fungal issues within the wood structure of the home. Moisture and mold are additional things that you can have in your home. So let's say your basement is getting water in it consistently. One of the big things that will happen in a high humidity environment is you will get fungus in the form of mold, and those spores will get into the air and they can be a major detriment to you and your family, as well as even your pets. So to prevent that, avoiding moisture from getting into those spaces, whether you're basement or crawl space, is going to make a big difference to prevent those. And then finally, and one of the most concerning things, is settlement or displacement of the footings or other structural portions of the home. So as water is able to soak in around the home from things like negative grade or overflowing gutters, you are going to increase the likelihood of movement of the structural base of your home. That's because as water gets into the soil becomes more malleable and able to move out of the way, so you can have footings sink. It also becomes much more heavy, the soil does, and so if you have a basement wall, you get what's called hydraulic pressure. So as the water builds up behind that wall, you can actually have a significantly increased amount of pressure on that wall from outside. So again, dealing with the water before it gets to that point is a major benefit to you as a homeowner and protects your home or your greatest liability. So how do you determine if you have negative grade? Well, for me, as both a home inspector and a homesteading and permaculture consultant, I'm going to be looking at the land, and you can do the same thing. So what you're going to be looking for is areas that drain towards the home. First, you're going to look on the uphill side, and I say uphill not meaning that it has to be a significant hill, but any slope of any sort, and look at how much of an area is actually collecting and draining towards the home. So that will give you an idea of volume. Then you're going to want to check to see if that side of your yard slopes away temporarily from your home. So the idea here is you want some type of channel so that as water comes down the slope towards your home, the water should run around your house before it gets to it, because you should have grading that slopes away from the house for between 6 to 10 feet at a minimum. That's typically called a curtain drain, and that's something that you always want to see around a home. What you can also do in observing the land is watch the water flow during a hard rain, so you may get a better idea of which way the water is flowing, where it's pooling, where issues might be because of a hard rain. And if you're watching during a hard rain, you may also get an idea of additional water that is coming, say, off of the roof or other hard surfaces. And let's say your gutters are clogged or your downspouts aren't running far enough away from the home, you'll be able to see that in a heavy rain event. In some cases, gutters just don't keep up with the amount of volume that's coming off the roof, or have other reasons that they may spill over because of incorrect slope. So keep an eye on those things as you are looking for negative grade or water issues around your house during a heavy rain. The last thing you can do to find or determine negative grade around your home is to use measurement tools. These are going to be tools like a transom level, water line levels, or A-frame levels, but all of these systems, when used right, can give you an idea of what the slope is in different areas and help understand how the water might be moving. And all of those levels, you can find information on YouTube on how to use them. So the last thing I wanted to cover is what can you do to fix these issues? And I'm going to start at the best fix, going to the last fix that you want to use. And the best fix is something called the curtain drain. Sometimes people will call this a diversion ditch, and there's a few other names that it goes by. This is where you want to make sure that in the side of the home where the yard is sloped towards the home, you have a section of the yard before it gets there that is sloped down and away from the home. This should create what would look like a fairly subtle V and will allow water to run around the home. And in some cases, to be able to do this, you need to do something like build a retaining wall so that you can have appropriate slope away from your home. This can get pretty complex, but the basics are fairly simple. Next is making sure that your gutters are working properly and that you have downspout extensions installed. Downspout extensions should be installed at least 6 feet away from the home, and that's really going to help keep the water from getting up against the home in the first place. Now, another thing that we can do to incorporate some permaculture ideas here is actually to put a swale uphill. This can be function stacked by making it a food production swale as well as a water diversion swale. So it can hold water on level or on contour, but then you can have the spillways of the swale move the water out and around where they'll no longer come towards your house. This will dramatically help with the amount of water that's coming at your house if you have a large collection area, to reduce that water so it's more manageable when it gets to the house. And the last thing, and this is where I say don't start with this, is a French drain and moisture barrier against the home. Now, these are things that contractors generally want to start with. One, because they oftentimes don't understand how water systems work, and two, because they're the most expensive things to do, and so they can make the most money at it. However, a French drain is really a last line of defense, and the same with a moisture barrier against a foundation wall. That's because if you put a moisture barrier in, water can still build up behind that moisture barrier, creating significant hydraulic pressure, even if water isn't pushing into the space. And that hydraulic pressure can cause the foundation walls to start to move inwards or away from the pressure that is being applied to it. And French drains really should do as little work as they have to. So if they're needed, you want to move as much water around the home before the water actually gets to the French drain. I hope that helps you understand how to address water in your yard coming towards your home better. If you have any questions, send them into Jack and I will do my best to get those answered for you. If you want to find my information, it is at thehomesteadconsultant.com, where I help people set up and plan out their homesteads. Or you can find me at clarityhomeinspection.com if you have a home inspection that you need done in the state of Tennessee. Thanks so much.
Good stuff. Let's now move on to John Pugliano. We're going to be talking about choosing an investment manager or investment management firm. And I'm just going to say, like, one of the things I love about John is the man is walking integrity personified. You just listen in his intro segment to, like, the full disclosure here, and that is one of those things that you just aren't going to get from everybody. You're just not. And, again, I am so grateful for all expert council members, present, past, and honestly, I know in the future other ones will come along, for giving so much. And John's just one fine example of that. So let me just at this moment say thank you to anyone that's ever served at any time as an expert council member, because it is a position of service. It really is. With that, let's hear from John.
Hello, TSP. We'll start out the year with a common question that I receive a lot about how to choose an investment advisory firm. Keep in mind, I run my own firm, so anything I say can be construed as promoting my own self-interest, so take it with a grain of salt. But here it is. Here's Brian's question, and he wants to know what he should be looking for in picking an investment advisor firm. Brian, before I get into directly answering your question, I will mention with the background data that you provided, you and your wife seem to have several old employer 401k plans where the money is still with those old employer plans. And as far as moving forward and managing your money, I would really encourage you more than anything, focus on consolidating those various accounts which you're probably not paying attention to and moving those into the appropriate IRA or Roth IRA accounts so that if nothing else, you at least have everything in one place and it'll simplify your life in terms of keeping track of everything and tax reporting and knowing where all that money and all those investments are. Now, as far as the actual question yourself, you mentioned that you and your wife are having consultations with some advisors in your area. One of them you mentioned is a kind of a national franchise. I won't mention their name. The other is an advisor that's teamed up with your credit union. Consider your meetings with these firms as an interview. You're interviewing them to assess your compatibility. Are they the kind of people you can talk to and communicate with? Do you feel comfortable with the answers they're giving you? Are they explaining the really complicated nature of the investments and the risks associated with those investments? You know, Jack calls people in this industry financial liars for a reason. At best, many firms are just salesmen masquerading as advisors, and at worst, they're simply con men. In your question, you mentioned that you've seen that it's advisable to use a fiduciary. So for people not familiar with that word, that's a descriptive term, and in a lot of ways, it's also just a marketing term. But generally speaking, a fiduciary is supposed to act in the client's best interest. And so you would ask yourself, well, why would the SEC or other organizations that are out there to protect the consumer, why would they allow firms to exist that don't have a mission to act in their client's best interest? But that's just the way it is. Now, generally speaking, the way that works is that fiduciary firms usually charge fees where non-fiduciary firms are paid commissions on products they sell. Again, generally, that's the way it breaks down. Now, there's no exclusion that you can't do one or the other. Many firms do it both ways. For the most part, I think from a logical standpoint, it makes sense that you'd want to be dealing with a fiduciary firm where you're being charged a fee for services and you know specifically what that fee is. But on the other hand, just because a firm is being compensated through commissions, it doesn't mean you're getting ripped off. I think it just provides more incentive for investment products to be pushed on you so that the salesman can make his money. In either case, though, whether the firm is a fiduciary or not, it doesn't mean that the investment outcome is going to be any better one way or the other, or a fiduciary firm is necessarily going to be more honest than a non-fiduciary firm. It really comes down to the people you're dealing with. So what I would encourage you as you're interviewing these advisory firms, if you're sensing strong-arm sales tactics, or if they're trying to impose a sense of urgency on you where, you know, you have to sign that contract, or you have to act now to get the best deal, or, you know, they're talking more like a car salesman or a timeshare salesman than they are about someone that's truly interested in helping you build your wealth, those salesman-like tactics will be the red flags which should warn you that you're not being advised about something that's in your best interest. So as far as finding an investment advisory firm that would be good for you to work with, I think really the best method is to talk to other people that are happy with their advisors, assuming that those people were in a similar situation to you, and then again, interview the advisors and make sure that the strategies that they're talking about align with whatever your long-term investment goals are. And the important thing to remember here is that a lot of this is simply personal choice. The investment advisory firm is very competitive and diverse, and there are large firms, there are small firms, there are regional firms, there are robo-advisors. It all depends upon the level of service and the type of organization that you want to work with. And without knowing more specifically about you, that's just some general information that I'd guide you with. Well, hey, as always, thanks for the questions. Look forward to a healthy and prosperous 2025. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Studying Podcast.
Well, great stuff as always from John. Let's move on now. We're going to talk about something I have an irrational hatred of, which is people that put ranch dressing on chicken wings. Before I bring Ken on to talk about these three options he comes up with, let me tell you what my problem with ranch really is. In and of itself, it's not that big a deal. It's just, I don't know, millennials, you guys broke it. Like, these people put ranch on effing everything. It doesn't go on effing everything. And it is not a recipe when you dump a bottle of ranch dressing on some chicken leg quarters, let them sit there for 10 minutes, and throw them in the oven. It's gross. Stop it. Anyway, I'll let it go. Ken, tell us what you think about all this.
Hello all, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's question comes from Tom. He asks, I've been using blue cheese dressing on super spicy wings and sweet wings forever. The wife uses sour cream on her wings, and I actually enjoy sour cream on wings too. What's your thoughts on blue cheese, ranch, and sour cream for wings? Thanks, Tom. It's certainly that time of year again. I eat more wings during college playoffs, NFL playoffs, the Super Bowl, and then it's March Madness. So it's no better time to perfect your wing production ritual. And as we all know, there is an endless amount of recipes for wing flavors and how to cook the perfect wing, and everyone's got an opinion. In fact, it's one of the most discussed topics on DrinkEatLearn.com. This is not the topic for today. We will leave the discussion for wing preparation for another day. The question is about dipping sauces today. And if you know me, it's about the science. Look, for purists, there's no substitute for traditional buffalo wings and blue cheese dressing. And as for me, I like my wings hot, really hot. Like, make me cry like a baby hot. And there's a lot of ways to add heat to the wings, but in the end, you're dealing with capsaicin, right? Capsaicin is this active compound in chili peppers that's responsible for their heat. And when you bite into a saucy wing, that capsaicin binds to receptors on your tongue. And your brain interprets this heat as pain, even though there's no damage that's actually happening. So why the hell do we love this pain? Well, because we're weird. And capsaicin releases endorphins. That's the body's natural painkiller, and it gives you this little bit of joy beyond the pain, you little freak. So what the hell does this have to do with dipping sauce? A lot, actually. The happy accident of buffalo wings and creamy blue cheese works on a scientific level, even if it wasn't intended to do so. Capsaicin is oil soluble, which means if you want to lessen the burn, water would just spread the burn all around your tongue. Instead, you should turn to dairy. In fact, I love to compete in hot wing challenges, and it's common practice among challengers to have a cold glass of milk right after being defeated by me. Dairy is the ultimate capsaicin extinguisher, and here's why. The protein casein found in dairy products like blue cheese, ranch dressing, sour cream, binds the capsaicin and washes it off your tongue naturally, killing the burn. Secondly, the fat in blue cheese, ranch, and sour cream acts like a buffer, coating your mouth with fat and dulls the heat. So for me, all three choices in dipping sauces make sense to calm the heat, but there are some flavor notes to consider. Traditional buffalo wings are made with Frank's Red Hot and butter. It's vinegar-based and can be one-sided in flavor, although very delicious. Blue cheese is the traditional dipping sauce, and in fact, asking for ranch in Buffalo, New York will probably get your ass kicked out the door immediately. The blue cheese is salty, creamy, and funky, just as bold as the buffalo sauce. It's a great combination of bar food science that shouldn't work, but it does. For me, ranch is delicious, but it should be used for barbecue wings, southern-style breaded wings, or grilled and smoked wings. Ranch is pure umami, and the richness of ranch pairs well with these intense flavors of each of these different styles, but really to all the same effect. Most people who put ranch on everything will find reasons to convince you why ranch is the best for all wings. They'll also convince you that boneless wings are a thing when you know damn well it's just chicken nuggets. Now, to sour cream. Sour cream for hot wings can be another great choice. It's tangy, creamy, and it provides this cooling sensation for heat and adds this fat and texture to otherwise traditionally sharp vinegar-based buffalo sauce. It does this without the funk of blue cheese. And some of you will never like blue cheese, and I will never get you to. The sour cream could be a good option. I'm leaving my recipe for a blue cheese dressing made from scratch, because if you really want to give traditional buffalo wing pairing with blue cheese dressing a try, don't buy pre-made salad dressing. It's worth the effort to make it from scratch. Okay, lastly, let's talk quickly about celery, even though it wasn't in the question. Love it or hate it, I believe and use celery to my advantage when eating hot wings. And I mean like Carolina Reaper question my will to live hot wings. Combine these with good blue cheese dressing. The celery, when chewed, can kind of cleanse your tongue and taste buds. It really helps me enjoy each bite and be ready for the next. Tom, I hope this gives you an idea why scientifically these choices make sense. Feel confident as you continue to explore different wing flavors and different dipping sauces. You at least know a bit of some science behind why these things naturally taste good. In the end, there is no wrong way to eat chicken wings. Unless you eat ranch dressing on traditional buffalo wings, then you are wrong, and I have no respect for you. Until next time, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers.
So I listened to it. I don't think he told you where they actually came from originally, like how it happened. Obviously, it's Buffalo. But there was this family that owned a bar in Buffalo, and the mom's son, you know, was typical young guy, and go out and hang and bar crawl with his buddies, and they'd always end their night at mom and dad's bar because, well, you can drink for free there, maybe get something to eat. Well, apparently they had ordered some chicken and they were sent wings by accident. A chicken wing was not considered like high quality eating back when this happened. A chicken wing was like a trash product. It was slave food in the minds of many, like turkey tails and things like that would be considered. And there's no good reason for it. It's just people are spoiled. Well, they had all these wings, and mom's like, well, shit, this is what you're getting. And so she also had some Frank's Red Hot butter, some celery laying around, and some blue cheese dressing. She didn't say, I'm going to formulate this thing because I think it'll all play well together. It's like, this is what I have, and it seems like it might work, and screw them. It's my freaking kid bumming on me after being out in other people's bars all night, spending money there, and then coming here. So here you go. Well, they loved them. And there is a show called The Food That Built America, and it talks about the genesis of the buffalo wing and a competing buffalo wing that was also made in Buffalo that was damn good but served as a whole wing without all the accoutrement. It's totally worth watching if you watch TV at all. It really is. That whole series is awesome. You learn about a lot about entrepreneurship and business and things like that. You also learn about a lot of the reasons why we're eating chemically backed food today. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and move on. Now we're going to hear from Mike Melito with the skinny on crossover carbates.
Hello, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life. I thought I would do a segment for you guys on cool crossover carbines. What I mean by that is not the most tactical of carbines, not the best big game hunting rifles, but something in the middle. For the guy that's not wondering, can I mix regular multicam with black multicam, or is that a fashion faux pas? Not for the guy that's like, I cannot wait till October so I can rub myself with doe urine. And I want the best rifle for each of those things. But the guy that's kind of looking for a handy rifle / carbine that can do both. Much like a Leatherman or any multi-tool. Not as good as a dedicated tool, but pretty good for a lot of different things. As the duality of survival guns go, defending yourself and putting food on the table. All right, with that, some really cool crossover carbines. The first one I'm going to mention is the Marlin Model 1894 44 Magnum Stainless Steel Trapper. Now, you could get other sub-variants of that, but the Marlin Lever Action 44 Magnum. 44 Magnum is a good crossover round in a carbine. It's good for deer at moderate ranges. It's a good defensive round out of a carbine. Generally too big for handguns in an EDC type scenario, but for a carbine, for your vehicle or whatever, it gives you a decent balance. Again, it's not a battlefield equivalent of an AR, I'm not saying that. But it's a good defensive carbine, if pressed into that role, if needed, and it's a nice, handy little deer woods carbine. Especially if you live east of the Mississippi or in the Pacific Northwest. I specifically went with Marlin, not because I don't like the Winchester levers, because it's got a flat top, optics are a force multiplier. You don't have to put optics on it, a good peep sight is good. You could mount an optic on there if you like. That's a really cool crossover carbine. Marlin 44 mag. The next one. What is faster than a lever action? A pump. How about the Remington 760 7600? These aren't being made currently, sadly, but there are a lot of them around and are not really highly coveted. Probably very undervalued, in my opinion, for what you get for the money. They come in many calibers. The most common by far is the 30-06, and that's fine. You get one in 308, that's fine too. So you get a fairly affordable, high-quality, American-made, reasonable rate of fire, full-powered rifle. Now, as much as people are crazy for the uber-long range, all the electronic whiz-bang stuff for hunting, in my opinion, the 760 and variants thereof are some of the finest spot and stalk and still hunting rifles ever fielded. So quick handling, quick follow-up shots, those also are not bad. You had to press them into a more tactical role. Not what you normally think of, but you could do a lot worse. What's faster still than a pump action? Well, a semi-auto. Why work the action when you don't have to? The next one on the list, kind of a sleeper, but it is the Ruger Mini 30. 7.62x39 is, in my opinion, one of the best round-per-round intermediate cartridges. If you're in a little bit more open country, you want a little bit more reach than the 44 mag we talked about earlier, you want rapid rate of fire, yes, they come in stainless, which I'm a big fan of. Like some of the other guns in 7.62x39, this gun comes with really good modern scope rings, ergo good optics mounting. I like the way they handle. Maybe one of the last of the generation, but I, in police work, used a Mini 14. I had access to full auto, Car 15s, M16s, all kinds of cool stuff. Full auto submachine guns, but you know what? No problem taking out a Mini 14. And a civilian, just regular Mini 14, they're a good fast handling carbine. The Mini 30, if you want to step up the round-per-round effectiveness of the cartridge, the Mini 30 is a good, good carbine. It doesn't scream tactical like an M4 or an AK-47, but it is tactical, and it is also a good, with proper bullet selection, not with full metal jackets, not with the Wolf, you know, hollow points, but with good, made-for-controlled expansion, with good ammo, it's a good medium game cartridge as well at reasonable ranges. That Ruger Mini 30, semi-auto, box magazine fed, shoulder fired, nice handy carbine. That's a good option. And last, probably my personal favorite on the list, the Ruger Gunsight Scout Rifle. Stainless steel, 16-inch, 308. Unlike many bolt actions today, it has really good usable iron sights. I'm a big fan of iron sights. You can also mount an optic, a low power optic, which I like for this kind of thing. And one of the reasons I like it, although a bolt action, not as fast a rate of fire as the guns we heretofore talked about in this segment, it is that legendary Mauser 98 pre-64 Winchester controlled round feed, three position safety, legendary action. It has an extractor claw that would make a velociraptor blush. It just got a big meaty claw on there. You're talking about austere environments, ice, snow, mud, things like that. I really like that controlled round feed, whether you want to call it a Mauser or a pre-64 Winchester type action. That Ruger Scout Rifle. And it's in a light handy carbine. You can get it in stainless steel. The box magazine fed. It's a reasonable weight. And it's a great hunting rifle. I like spot and stalk and still hunting. It's one of my go-to hunting rifles. 308 is perhaps the most logical choice in today's market if you want a good all-around one-rifle cartridge. There's a lot of tactical options. There's a lot of really, really good hunting options. And it's generally one of the most affordable round-per-round cartridges. That Ruger Scout Rifle, a really good all-around option. And before I sign off, Jack can edit this out if he wants, but I'm going to settle this debate right now. The most underrated cartridges, it's a dead even tie between the 6.5x55 Swede and the 35 Whalen.
Well, let's start off with the last part about underrated cartridges. I'm a huge fan of the 35 Whalen, and I'm a huge fan of the 35 Bore, and I definitely think it's a contender for the top of the heap. My only thing about that when I really look at performance is it's somewhat younger brother, the 338-06. My God. If you can get a point where ballistic coefficient and weight and energy and trajectory come together for this thing of beauty, you know, with something like a 225 grain bear claw around, I mean, I don't know. That's like the debate about the 308 and the 3006 if the 308 didn't have a shorter action. I mean, it's that academic. So I'll let that go. A 6.5 Swede, I'm not sure that got in there. And I did intend to include it. I don't remember if it got in my polls in my Sweet 16. If it didn't, it was because the 260 Remington, which is basically a modern version of it ballistically, did so poorly. So I may have decided. I don't really remember, but I agree with that. On the guns that he mentioned, okay, I have a very special place in my heart for the 760 Remington pump gun, but he said carbine. And so the one thing I want to point out is that particular gun, the 760 is the original, 7600, slightly newer version thereof. These were incredibly popular when I was growing up, and well, my dad honestly was a young man in Pennsylvania. Probably the 336 Marlin lever gun and a Remington 760 were the guns you saw more than, or military surplus. Like 90% of the guys at a deer camp had one of those three things, like an old 303 British or an Enfield or something, like an American Enfield, an .06. So they still even had an .06, right? But it is a fantastic gun, and it is one of the still available super sweet deals on classic firearms, especially if you live somewhere like Texas or Oklahoma where gun shows are a big deal. I see them all the time. They're very affordable relative to new guns, and some of them are sweet as hell because this is the whole thing about underrated. Everyone wants the newest gun and the newest ammo and the newest special thing, and that was the whole point of that poll, and that's why I said I probably should have put 3006 in that poll. Well, everybody's got one, yeah, but it's underrated. Everybody now wants something better. You know, these are rounds that, all of the rounds that I put in there for their purpose do everything you could ask for. You know, not all of them are good for hunting black bear, but the ones that are in the class for hunting black bear, it's all you need and more, right? Anyway, on some other stuff I wanted to add on to Mike's segment, which is an excellent segment, and completely unprepared. Like, I just said I need some content, and that was just one he created for us. Excellent job, Mike. Thank you. The Wolf Ammo in 7.62.39, it's effing garbage from a performance standpoint. I agree with that. Specifically, the Wolf Hollow Points, they might as well not be hollow points. Let me be clear. If you want cheap shit to go to the range with and plink and shoot and enjoy, it's fine for that. It is dog shit for performance. How do I know? I've owned a few guns in my time that fire that round. And I've shot a lot of Wolf through them, and it works. It functions just fine. But I have put Wolf Hollow Point rounds through things like a 4x4, like a pressure-treated piece of 4x4. And recovered the projectile. They don't expand. I don't even understand how Wolf builds a hollow point that does what these things do. They literally collapse on themselves. There's zero expansion. None. The whole front just, it's like somebody pushed it in flat and it like caves in on itself and there's no expansion. I mean, there might be, if you put a caliper on it, you know, it might be 31 or 32 caliber, if that. It might as well just be a full metal jacket. And I've shot them in dirt. I've shot them into just about everything I can think of to try to get one. I can never get one to expand. They either do nothing or they collapse on themselves. Don't buy that shit. Don't use it for anything but target practice and planking. It's junk. Then the other gun that I would consider a carbine worth looking at, but it's brand new. I'm going to say it's completely overpriced right now. They're selling at MSRP or above, and it's probably too much of a case queen right now to have made Mike's segment. But it is the Henry Supreme lever action that just came out. It's available in 223. I have no interest in it in 223. I have a lot better platforms for that round. But they also make it in 300 blackout. It's a 16-inch barrel, lever action, large handle lever action, smooth as butter, what you get from Henry all the time. And 300 blackout, man, and the fact that you can have your paperwork done for a suppressor now, right in like a day, man, I'll tell you why I haven't bought one yet. The only reason, because it's so new and so in demand that it's selling at or above MSRP. Give it a few months. Let all the people that buy the newest thing, as soon as it comes out, as fast as possible, the gun equivalent of the people that stand in line when the new iPhone comes out, when those people are done and sales go to normal, this will probably come in with a street price of $850 to $950. And I'll probably buy one then. Now, not even in the league of what he was talking about, because everything he had there was some sort of repeating arm. I do want you to know, if you want the most fun you can have for about $300, okay, that Rossi makes a single shot in 300 blackout with a threaded barrel. And if you already have a suppressor, you almost wonder why you didn't buy one of these things yet. And with the subsonic rounds and that close breach, man, you can hear the hammer fall over the report of the round. It is just sweet as shit for that amount of money. So I just thought I'd throw that out there. All right, now let's talk about my actual segment today, and I'm going to try to be kind of brief with it because I think this is going to be kind of long for an EC show. This came in late yesterday afternoon, and so I can only assume that it had actually it came in yesterday morning. The day after I did my show on Underground Meat. So I can only assume that the two things are connected. This comes from, we'll just call him Jeff, longtime listener from Alberta, Canada. Question from episode 3609. Well, that would confirm my suspicions on small meat operations. I'm on 3.9 acres. I do pigs and chickens. We have very high food values and choose not to feed canola or soy to our animals. I didn't know anybody fed animals canola, but okay. Because of that choice, my product is a lot more expensive than others. We're at a point where we can either scale down just to suit our needs or sacrifice that value to attract customers. The third option, and this is where I need help, is how does one attract the right clients that share those values? I'm a 2.5-hour drive from both major cities. I just don't know how to advertise when it's all gray market in Canada. The fine now can be up to $100,000 if caught. Serious shit up here in Clown Canada. Anyway, if you could speak on that and come at it from a different angle, that'd be great. I could teach classes in some of the cities to maybe attract clients, and if I tailor the class correctly, but I am at a loss with how to do that. So I'm going to come out with this with some ideas, but I'm going to lead with this. You don't do things just because they're gray market. You don't do things just because you're giving the middle finger to the man. And you certainly don't just do things because Jack Spirko says it's a good thing to do. Because when I say anything's a good thing to do, I'm always being situational. So don't do this just to do this. You should only do this if you can see and capture an opportunity. And your summation that maybe the best thing to do is pull back till you're raising for just yourself may be the right answer. If we want to try, here's some underground ways that maybe we can make this work. Your idea of teaching classes in the city is not a terrible idea. I'm going to temper everything I'm about to say with this, though. 2.5 hours is a long way for somebody to go to pick up food. You know, you do pigs, so if you're doing whole pigs for people, then maybe they'll show up. But nobody's coming out to pick up some pork chops, a loin, a dozen chicken eggs, and two chickens. They're not driving 2 hours for that. Okay? So you need to think about that strategically. And what you could do to sell the pigs is do, for instance, what we're doing with Crunchy Mama Farm, where you run a class on the processing of pigs. But again, I don't know Canadian law. I have no idea how that works. But if what you were really advertising was the workshop, but the pork was divided up among the students, that may be a way not only to make it work and make a profit, but it would be a way to get people accustomed to your product, and they may say, well, this was really cool, I would just like more pig, please. And you may be able, once you have the relationship, to create a dynamic and then learn your law. Learn what you really can and can't do. There's so many places the state is so dominant, but they've only been able to get so many things actually illegal, and what they like to do is create this illusion that you can't, and out of fear, then you don't move because you hear a big number like $100,000, and I wouldn't do anything that could potentially cost you that. You're never going to make that selling pigs and chickens in profit. So it's not worth the risk. Remember I said you build the risk into the price? You can't do it with that. But you may find out there's a lot of loopholes that you can stand under and walk through with this. So this would be a good idea if you could find a lawyer that's familiar with this type of law in Canada and talk to them, even maybe give them a couple $100 for about a 1 hour consultation. Just say, hey, can you help me game out whether this is worth doing or not? And if so, what is the legal way that I can do this and protect myself from the onerous, you know, actions of the state? Now understand that unless it's a lawyer that cares about this shit, their answer is going to be don't do it, because lawyers always play to the safest side. You need someone that's a bit of a renegade but still a good lawyer to help you with that. Another thing though is, and I have found this to be the case, most of the people that I've spoken to that have built up good amounts of business raising things like pigs and cattle and sheep, chickens less from what I'm about to say, though chicks are cute, they build big presences on social media sites like Instagram, posting pictures of baby animals. You would think the people that look at the pictures of the baby animals would not want to eat the baby animals, but you would be wrong. About 20 to 30% of those people love the little baby animals, still want to eat them when they're big and ugly. And you will often have people then maybe reach out to you and ask you questions like that. You take that kind of on the down low from that point forward, but you always have to be careful you're not dealing with a Canadian Fed. How much effort do they put into this? Again, I'm very comfortable advising people on stuff like this in the United States, and especially in states that I'm familiar with, like Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, less so California. I'm very skittish on this in Canada. Now, my real statement then would be to you is, do the people that you can talk to who don't want to pay your price understand what you're doing? And what you may want to do is run some little workshops for locals and specifically target the people that don't do it for themselves already. The problem you have in rural communities is you have to do a thing that somebody else isn't already doing for themselves. It's very hard to sell peppers and tomatoes in rural Pennsylvania because everybody that wants peppers and tomatoes has a garden. So they grow peppers and tomatoes and cucumbers and dillweed and onions and broccoli. You see what I'm saying, right? You have to be in a place where there's enough people with money who don't do the thing that you do and are willing to pay for it so somebody will do it for them. This is the same with any business. And it's very easy for us to build a book of business here because I live on the urban-rural fringe of a metroplex with over 6 million people in it. There's only, from my knowledge, like 39 people in Canada, the whole country. And you live in a rural part of Canada, so there's going to be a limit to what you can do there. I think it's even hard to sell eggs in Canada. So maybe if you want to build that local business, do some things to attract people onto the land, show them what you do, let them understand the economics behind it. Because when somebody knows, like, okay, to grow this 200-pound pig, this guy's got maybe $200 in it. Well, I can't expect to buy it for $210. That's unreasonable. Now, I want to explain one really important fundamental fact about sales from an old sales saying, and it applies to marketing too. There are two things you can never sell to: ignorance and poverty. So if you have people around you who simply do not have the money to purchase the type of product that you're producing, you're already done. And if you can't locate those people, do something else and sell something else that you legally can. Use your farm to create some other product that doesn't even have to fly under the radar. Something maybe easy to ship or something. Find another monetization method if that's going to be the issue. On ignorance. While this is exactly how it was taught to me, it's rampant in the sales industry, and it's everything from top end, you know, C-level sales like I used to do, down to people that knock on doors and try to sell life insurance. That term is used. Ignorance and poverty. Can't sell to it. I don't agree with it. I made one slight adjustment to it. You cannot sell to willful ignorance, and you cannot sell to poverty. Now, ignorance you can sell to because it's your job as a sales consultant, which is what, as a good salesman, is first and foremost a consultant, is to educate the prospective customer as to the value of the product. If the person is simply ignorant, then telling your story, which is the you know, absolute definition of marketing, is telling your story. Sales is transfer of belief. Viral marketing is getting other people to tell your story. Okay? If you can master those three things, you can sell anything, but you can also go to jail for selling meth. So don't take that too far, all right? So we get back to the willful ignorance thing. If you realize that you're talking to somebody that does not want to understand why your product's worth what it's worth, then you need to stop talking to them, period. If you're talking to somebody that you know cannot afford to buy your product, as soon as you determine that, stop talking to them. All that could possibly happen is you end up making them realize how shitty their food is and make the problem that's all they can afford to eat worse, unless maybe you were teaching them how to do it for themselves. Another option would be, I don't know how co-op type arrangements, food clubs, maybe look for people that want to partner together and basically own the animal that you raise for them. And then it's like a self-processing thing or something like that. Like, I guess that's another way you could come at this. But here's my confusion. Either everything I'm being told about the price of groceries in Canada is a lie, or what you're paying for feed is insane. Because when I'm looking at people walk out of a grocery store with for $100 in Canada, I don't even, and as bad as it is here, I don't even understand how there hasn't been a full-on, like, blood in the streets, pull the parliament out by their necks and hang them from streetlights revolution in Canada. And I'm not saying that to encourage it at all. I really ain't. I'm saying that I've studied those types of uprisings through history, and when people can't afford to eat, that's when that shit happens. And you look like you're there, so maybe it's affecting feed prices too. So my other thing is, and this is the only other thing I can come up with for you in this situation, is that your job, as I said, once you identify a thing that can be profitable, even if you haven't gotten it there yet, is to increase efficiency and lean out expense. And what I'm betting is, you know, it's easy to say that as a Yank down here in southern United States. You probably have a lot more narrow of a window of time that these animals can be gaining a lot of their nutrition from the land itself. So I don't know how you can increase your production and decrease your cost of production. But that's your actual problem if you would have buyers otherwise. Because here's the other thing. A lot of people, I don't know, man, that sounds too expensive. They go right down to Piggly Wiggly and they pay more for a shittier product. You have to be sure before you talk about discounting anything that the price is actually the problem. Or is perception of price the problem? So here's another, this is back to education. If the person's ignorant but not willfully ignorant. There are a lot of people, especially in rural communities, that they think, man, I remember when food was so much more affordable, and that guy's just raising it himself. His should be cheaper. They don't understand. They've never actually done it. They have actually no idea what it costs to do it. And they have no idea about the difference in quality. So a lot of times a person that says it's too expensive because they don't know what it is. What if I told you I had a car for sale and I wanted you to buy it? And it's a nice car. It's fast and it looks good. And I want $80,000 for it. Well, you'd tell me probably go piss up rope. But if it turned out that that car was like a Maserati that you could turn around and sell for $250,000, you'd say, how many can I get? Because even if you didn't want one, you'd go out and make a profit on it. You would see the value because you'd know what I'm actually selling you. So do these people know what you're selling, and do they care about what you're selling? And again, you have to figure out what you can do, how much you can do, how much you risk by doing it, and is this even right for you? My gut, and I hate saying it this way, but my gut is you're right. Stop trying to do it for other people. Or, you know, do the Joel Salatin thing. Raise 10 extra chickens. Give all 10 of them to 10 different people. And part them out for them, because I talked about how people are retards about parting out a chicken. They throw the whole chicken in the freezer. I'll get to it someday. But if you make it look like what they already buy, they might even then become the person that'll buy the whole chicken and do it once they understand it. Part them out, hand them out for free. And when they say, can I get more? They're $25 a piece. Well, that's too expensive. We'll go back to eating Tyson. By the way, would you like, since I gave that one you free, to come by and see how we do this and why it costs that much? Or, you know, whatever it costs. That's what I got. And anybody that's maybe succeeded in Canada with something like this, let me know, because it's a different world. I don't know how Canada has allowed the talons of socialism to grow so deep. I think it's because y'all are too fucking nice, to be honest. Everybody talks about how nice Canadians are. You know, here's the thing. This is what one of my mentors, one of my military mentors taught me. Always be nice until nice doesn't work anymore. And as soon as nice doesn't work anymore, it's time to no longer be nice. I'm just saying. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Thank you guys for tuning in today. Tomorrow will be a Friday flashback. Definitely check that out. If you want to submit a question for members of the Expert Council, I encourage you to do so. Email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPCExpert in the subject line. Ask your question in one sentence with a question mark at the end of it. Hit the return key a couple times and give me all the details you want. Just ask the question first. Bottom line up front. It'll work better. I'll know what you're asking. You'll know what you're asking. The expert will know what you're asking, and we'll try to get you an answer. It's also good if you know what expert you want to answer it. You tell me who that is. Throw out a little invitation here. I got a question today about lip balm. And I gave the answer that I gave, and you know, I do make some herbal concoctions and things like that, salves and what have you, but I'm not an herbalist. It's one of those things I know a lot about, but I just tend to like pick a product and buy it. And because of that, I only really know about the things that I've ever wanted or needed. I don't know a lot about things that maybe somebody else wants or needs. It got me thinking, do we need an herbalist on the Expert Council? We've given that a shot a couple times. I hate to put it this way, but it's attracted some weird people, I guess, or people that are involved with like network marketing sales and shit like that. I'm talking about someone that actually knows their shit about herbs and herbal medicines. And maybe if we had somebody that really specialized in that, we would get a lot more questions on it and build more content. And I'm always trying to increase the diversity of topics on the show day to day, and especially the Expert Council. And I've kind of decided I want to build the council larger than it ever was in my head, because we have ebbs and flows of people finding things they need to go do and they can't do it anymore, or they're just busy for a while, or something comes up and then my content drops and then I got a surplus. It's like a high tide, low tide situation. The bigger the council, the more people involved, you know, the more diversity in it of topics, the less likely I am to end up on a Thursday going, shit, can I make a show today? Because sometimes I've not ever gotten there, but I felt that way on Wednesday a few times. On that, if you are an expert council member, and when I shook the piker tree on Tuesday, you got something into me, and I didn't play it today. It isn't because you did anything wrong. Every segment I got was good, guys. A lot of y'all fell out of the piker tree, and I got a lot of I'm almost got enough content to do next week right now. So thank you guys all for that. Everybody, again, tomorrow will be a flashback, so I'll say have a great weekend right now. Take care, and I'll catch you on Monday. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.